Hello, grandkids, and welcome to Stunt Granny Audio Presents OPA number 164. This is Kevin DeFrango. On the other end is Ken Phillips. What is going on, good sir?
Well, you know, I think there's some kind of rumors that there's stuff is going to start reopening at some point here, Kevin.
Well, there is no rumor anymore, honestly. It's... The door is slightly ajar at this point. I do feel like, A, people have kind of adapted to the situation pretty well. I feel like the drive-through processes and call-ahead ordering, I think a lot of the kinks have been worked out. So things are working a little more efficiently now, which makes things kind of easy. Like the beer ordering process is very easy these days. I like variety too much to commit to a beer delivery. 'Cause all of the beer delivery, you need to buy a case. And I'm like, I don't want that many. Like, I need some options. Like, you can still get options within one company, but I do like to spread the love. And, you know, you can't do that when you're ordering a case at a time. But anyway, things are kind of opening back up. I have not heard anything about any doors opening back up for me quite yet. But construction is supposed to be one of those things that is being more allowed currently, which would mean a return to work at some juncture, I would imagine. Which would be completely fine by me, because this whole not having a job thing is kind of crazy.
Yeah, it sounds keeping pretty busy with house projects, but probably wanting to get back into one of the old job projects there.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's kind of nice that things are ajar, but there are a lot of things that just are definitely not going to happen quite yet. You know, large gatherings are definitely a thing that is not still not happening. Restaurants still not happening.
Yeah, I think they're going to try to encourage people to work from still, probably, if you can.
Yes.
In offices and things. So, it's doing it some ways, but you're right. It has been an easier experience to order online and pick things up. I would say a lot of places were surprisingly quick at being able to kind of around and get that stuff going, but it probably makes sense because it's in their interest to do that, but
yeah,
I would say that I had a pretty good experience getting a growler filled at Barley's. They also have a service, bring a growler, they will take it and then sterilize it, but it'll be like a growler bottle exchange, basically. You'll get a different bottle back. So they bring it out to you, which is kind of nice.
Yeah, I haven't... I feel like that is a little bit of a wrinkle that people are just adding now, is the growler exchange. I know who... I'm trying to think of the company that they just have multiple taps, Daily Growler. That they always worked on an exchange basis. Like, you could never take home the one that you brought.
Oh, interesting.
And it was a little more and you could only bring in and out their growlers, which was the one problem that I didn't like about it. Was that you couldn't just... But they did have some of the nicer growlers with extra gasket on the bottom of the cap to help seal it a little bit better. I always felt like those growlers maybe fetched you an extra day or two as far as, you know, the quality not going down.
Gotcha.
And I did, I was a little bit surprised. I did today get some crowlers from Sideswipe Brewing, and they said that those were good for 3 weeks, because I was kind of wondering if I was going to bust one of those out tonight or not. I chose not to, but I'm ready to consume those.
I was thinking you probably didn't want to do a exchange with your CO2 pressurized growler that you have.
That is strictly forbidden at this point. I do still have some, that's another project that honestly I haven't gotten around to that I probably could get around to. There were some connection problems that I needed to fix with that growler that need to be corrected in the meantime. So that one, but yeah, it does not look like that's going to be useful though anytime soon. The carbonated growler.
It's in the shop for now, at least.
That is definitely on the shelf. Like, yeah, and I'm not exchanging $90 for a $5 bottle growler.
No.
That is the opposite of a good investment. And I don't want $90 worth of bottled growlers for that. That also not a good investment.
Yeah, that just makes sense.
And plus, I guess I have enjoyed the Crowlers, or the Howlers, as some people have been calling them, the 32-ounce ones, a lot more. Again, since I kind of force myself into variety more than having, like, a go-to beer or something like that, I do, the smaller bottles, I think, kind of work out a little bit nicer for me. Because then I can do a little more variety.
It's a half growler. Is that the howler comes from there?
Yeah.
All right. I get it.
I figured it was pretty self-explanatory. Because I'm like, what's a howler? And then I'm like, oh. Like, it hit me pretty quick. So I figured if I could figure it out, you'd pick up on it well enough.
I think I got that one better than the Crowler the first time. That one took me a little bit too.
Yeah, that's a can growler. In this case, I bought can howlers, really, from Sideswipe, because they're only 32 ounces, in which a traditional growler is 64, if people are unaware of this fact.
If I'm just continuing the same rules in construction of these names, I think that would be called a cowler. If you're beginning sound with a C and you don't have the R anymore, so a can howler, a cowler.
Oh yeah, I think that you're right. That should not be a crowler. It should be a cowler. It would make it would make more sense, and that would be a very large can. If it was in a true, like, a crowler, a 64-ounce can would be huge. Because obviously that's like 1.5 times a 40.
I think that Foster's had, like, a particularly large beer cans, but I don't believe they were ever that big.
I don't think they
were a 64-ouncer.
Yeah, I want to say that those were probably double deuces that Foster's had. I didn't really have, shockingly enough, I did not have too many of those back in the day. I guess yeah, I just I didn't have that much Fosters in general.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm seeing 24-ounce cans for Fosters. My preliminary ching here. So, yeah, that's not that exciting, really.
Oh.
I mean, that's pretty big.
Yes.
But it's not 32 ounces.
No.
It's getting there. It's getting to be in the ballpark, though.
Oh, yeah. That's pretty solid, honestly. If it weren't for the fact that... although, I was going to say, the one cowler that I got today was 5.8% alcohol, but I think the other was 8.3 or 8.5. That's just going to slap you upside the head a little bit different than a Foster's 24-ounce can.
Yeah, I would think so.
I guess I wonder what a... Now I'm going to have to look it up on... Untapped's going to be wondering why I'm looking up Foster's beer. They're going to kick me off the app for even looking.
Well, I hope I don't end up doing.
Oh my gosh!
Doesn't end up doing to your beer recommendations what it has been doing to your sport. You know, obscure English sports recommendations ever since you we moved the darts topic a while back. Could throw your beer references into a tizzy there. Recommendations.
Wow. It's a pale lager, which I was not aware of. But 4% ABV. Like, I didn't realize how close to, like, I mean, wow, that is shockingly low. Because even, like the Bud Lights of the world still sit at, like, I want to say, like, a 4.7.
A Bud Light, you think, even?
4.2. Oh, wow, man. No wonder you had to drink so many of those to get drunk. I thought that they were a little bit higher. Maybe it's the Bud Heavy. Oh, that's 5%.
Isn't there a Bud Nighttime or something like that they came out with recently? I think that was a higher percentage.
Bud Light Platinum is 6%.
Oh, maybe that was it. Yeah.
Oh, well, Natural Light was definitely one of my go-tos in college. And it's 4.2%. But, yeah, I'm not seeing, I don't think it was the Bud Select. Because it was the Platinum Night. Was there something, I'm trying to think of what other things that Budweiser has... Oh, and do you want to take a guess at what Natural Ice ABV was? If you remember the Natural Ice from back in the day.
Well, I guess I'm going to say it was on the low side. I'm going to go with 4.5%.
Oh, 5.9, sir. All the ice beers were a little bit higher in ABV. Because I want to say that I did the natural, but the ice house was definitely one that I would have hit more often.
Yeah, I think I can remember a lot of hangovers caused by ice house beer. Because I think it was like a value beer in terms of alcohol percentage.
5.5% for Ice House. Yeah, I mean, that was pretty dirt cheap, all things considered. But that caused a terrible hangover.
Yeah. Well, Kevin, do you think that the Steelers are having a hangover their draft this year?
No hangover draft for the Steelers, I don't think. I'm trying to remember or trying to think of whether they had a harder time with the draft because they only had late draft picks, or if it was easy because they did not have very many draft picks this year.
One thing that I've kind of seen people thinking that the Ravens ended up having a pretty good draft year this year. And one thing that people pointed, or this article I read pointed out, was that the Ravens picked up, was it Dobbins from Ohio State?
Yes.
After passed on him. I mean, you could see him as maybe being a potential value in the draft at that point. But I think they end up going with a wide receiver, from what I understand. Kind of a bigger wide receiver.
Yeah, they did go with Chase Claypool in the second round, was their first round to pick in. And, yeah, they decided to go with the wide receiver from Notre Dame. They had kind of tipped their hat off that they were going to pick a wide receiver. It is one that, for the Steelers, is very young. You know, when Juju Smith-Schuster is like the vet holding down the wide receiving core, and he's only fourth year pro. He hasn't been with the Steelers for very long. I think it's this year would be his fourth year.
He's not old enough to drink when he started playing for the Steelers.
Yeah, so not only is he NFL young, he is also young. And James Washington was another young wide receiver. And Deontay Johnson came on and played pretty well for the Steelers last year. The smaller slot guy out of Toledo. So it'll be, I guess I don't mind them adding someone else into that wide receiver room. As long as, like, it's kind of one of those things where if Mike Tomlin and I think we've talked about this, the infamous, I'll run him until he can't run. Was that what he said about Willie Parker? People were worried about his durability. And Tomlin's like, nah, man, he's just going to keep on running until he keeps on running. Like, I think there's been enough data shown recently that running backs get really beat up. And that maybe spreading the pain over a number of running backs is better than just kind of having your traditional star running back situation. And I think that the topic has come up between the two of us before that they really could go with James Conner and Benny Snell, whom they both drafted relatively high. Second or third round draft picks, I want to say. This would be Connor's third or fourth year. Yeah, his fourth year also. And I believe it'll be second year for Benny Snell. If you have some level of faith in those two to be able to split the load, which, again, Tomlin has been adverse to that, but I do think that it seems a little more in vogue in the NFL now than it has in some other times to me. I think
the strategy was that the running back would be able to get a better feel for the game and the tendencies of the defense be as they stay in there and get into the flow of the game more. You're right. I would think like getting worn out and just beat up over the course of a game and season would have to take its toll. even though I remember, you know, Jerome Bettis seemingly able to continue to like game as the game went on. I don't know. I'm sure he took a beating as well.
Yeah, and there are still some certain people that can do that, like that Derrick Henry for the Titans. He can do that, but I forget what his size is. The guy's like 6'6 or something like that, and 250 some odd pounds. Like, he's the size of a normal linebacker. You know, a lot of starting linebackers aren't even 255 these days, honestly, and Derrick Henry's that big. And I mean, but Bettis was definitely kind of that size playing when bigger people were playing also. The level of speed that takes place now in the NFL is pretty unbelievable. Like, you kind of wonder if someone like a Jerome Bettis might have made it in the NFL, just because his 40 time would not have been fast enough.
No, he always had nimble feet, but he wasn't really, you know, the fastest off the starting block, I guess you'd say. The fastest accelerator there.
Yeah. Yeah, he could rip off some runs, but he usually wasn't going to the house more times than not. Right. So, yeah, it's kind of interesting to go with the wide receiver since they have a young wide receiving core already. And I guess I'm not sure how much the running back is going to play into it. Especially since they did end up picking up kind of a... They definitely picked up a change of pace back in Anthony McFarland Jr. Who I believe they picked up, in the fourth round. And Mike Tomlin's son played there. So you get the easy counter arguments. Mike Tomlin saw him more than most people, so he has a pretty good idea of what he can do. And then there's also the just bias because he was on a team with his son argument that you can easily make. I believe that time will tell whether it was good. I guess the thing that does worry me about Dobbins going to the Ravens is it does make the Ravens harder to play against, I think. They didn't really have... I'm trying to think if they had a number one back last year or if they kind of switched things up. Because I want to say that Mark Ingram, who had played quite a few years for New Orleans, was playing there in Baltimore last year. But it's going to make them hard to defend, but it's also one of those things where I still have so much faith in the Steelers' defense that I'm not concerned. You know, like, I think that if they're as good this coming year as they were this past year, and most indications are they should be, I don't see any reason to worry. Like, they should keep you in most games. And the Steelers' offense was just complete trash most of last year. And it's just got to be mediocre. Like, I'm not expecting Roethlisberger, Bell, Antonio Brown numbers from the offense. You know, like... This is not your Steelers offense of a mere 3 years ago.
No. It'll be interesting to see how well Roethlisberger does when he comes. I mean, he's obviously going to be promised improvement, you know, for the offense over last year. That'll be something. I've read a couple sources saying that it seems like it's not in the cards for Juju Smith-Schuster to be sticking around after, and partially because of them drafting that receiver I don't know. That would kind of be a bummer just because he's always been a kind of a fan favorite, I guess. He only had a down season last year.
Yeah, that seems like a logical route to take. I know that a couple of seasons ago, Mike Tomlin talked about putting more bodies in the room to kind of cause competition within the team itself. And I feel like they've kind of followed that recipe a lot in the draft, where sometimes they're drafting people that in some ways they don't necessarily need, but they're going to help push other players. And, you know, seeing a wide receiver drafted, I would hope that first that maybe that would get the wide receiver's attentions just in general. And not just Juju. Like, I mean, I could see Juju walking. It would suck. Like, I know that he had Antonio Brown there for 2 years, so that some of those catches might have been a little bit easier to make because people were double teaming someone else. But he still made some nice catches, and it honestly seemed like his hands, for some reason, were the bigger problem last year, which was pretty weird. You know, it didn't seem like it was he wasn't making separation or he wasn't beating the double teams. Like, sometimes he was, and it was the lack of, you know, I guess it was probably more of a combination of things. Because, I mean, how many times did we talk about Mason Rudolph not looking downfield last year?
Quite a few times.
You know, like, some of it was Juju's, you know, when he did get called, and I think that's what magnified it. When he did get called on, it was fairly rare, and then he let one slip through his hands, and it just was a bigger deal because there just weren't many attempts that were down the field, and when you drop one of those, it just makes it look worse. Yeah, I mean, there are kind of a lot of things at play, I guess, with the Steelers taking a wide receiver at their number two spot. But again, like with today's NFL, it's not surprising to take a wide receiver either. Like, there's a lot of four wide receiver sets. Like, the Steelers haven't particularly run that many, but if you have faith in your receivers, why wouldn't you do something like that? And they haven't had a lot of faith in their tight ends recently, ever since Heath Miller left, honestly, 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah, Vance McDonald had a couple of shots, but never really caught on as a kind of receiver there, for sure.
Yeah, and Eric Ebron is supposed to be something of an improvement. We will see as time moves along. And that's it. There are some people saying that Chase Claypool, I think he was at one point, because he was so big, considered a tight end. Because I think he's 6'6", if I'm not mistaken, and he was like in the 240s or 250s himself. So people thought he might be a tight end, so he actually slimmed down to make sure that he kind of had more of a receiver body. Because I think he might have even been 255. Like, he might have knocked off 20 pounds to have more of a receiver build, which is still pretty huge. 235 is still pretty huge for a receiver.
Wanted to have you out there. This other thing is a crazier, I don't know, more speculative sort of idea that Aaron Rodgers could see his way to be playing for the black and gold within a couple of years. I mean,
wow.
I think that's based on the way they drafted a quarterback this year. You know, I guess speculating that Rodgers would be not wanting to play there if they were going to go to another. He had some other guy breathing down his neck, or I'm not sure.
Well, yeah, everyone started joking about the Packers drafting someone and Aaron Rodgers not helping him. Those memes definitely hit the airwaves during the NFL draft. And just speaking of that, did you watch any of the draft itself?
I did not watch the draft.
Well, there was one point, and I'm not going to do it because this is literally my grandmother's rocking chair or recliner chair. And it's going to be hard to get back out of, and I'd probably fuck up the recording equipment at the same time. But there was one point where there's a fireplace off to Roger Goodell's one side, and he was fully reclined in a recliner like this one, and announcing draft picks. And it was one of the most surreal things. Because the Steelers did not have a day one draft pick, I did not bother to tune in. If it's not important to my team, I don't care that much. And
so wait, was he like wearing a full suit now? I'm trying to picture
this. He was wearing like some type of khaki pants, a sweater, and a button down that had, of course, the top button undone. As he sat there with his cue card announcing what the draft pick was.
Like fully reclined?
Yeah, fully reclined. Like, I was just like, what is going on here? Like
the back? Is laid back like
the back says, is know? Laid back. The feet are in the air on an appropriate footrest, and he's announcing draft picks. And I'm like, I'm here for this. I guess like I didn't know that I was here for this, but I'm here for this. Like, it got so weird that it was, because I just tuned in expecting to check on the Steelers. It might have been third round draft pick, which is another interesting one, which I think is a good one, which is the outside linebacker, Alex Highsmith. I was going to go with Hightower, but that's one where they definitely need some backup for their current outside linebackers. Like, he's not going to crack the starting lineup because one guy just got franchise tagged and the other guy's TJ Watt. And, you're not taking out the guy that was just in the running for Defensive Player of the Year. It's just not happening. But to have someone is his backup, or even Bud Dupree's backup, is something that was definitely needed, I think. So, and I guess that's the other thing, is the Steelers have drafted kind of practical the last few years. Like, not only are they drafting for, like, I think the wide receiver was more of a to get competition, but the rest of the draft picks were all stuff that they kind of needed. They needed it because they lost a couple of linebackers through free agency. So they needed another one for that. And they needed a running back, which they got. They needed their offensive line took a little bit of a hit, so they got an offensive lineman. They got a safety in the sixth round, and then a defensive tackle in the seventh round, which is another one where no one's going to crack the starting lineup necessarily, so just to kind of maybe put people in there is even better backups will, Yeah, they were addressing areas of need with this draft, as per usual, I feel like. And, yeah, I mean, I guess I feel pretty good about it, you know? And we've already discussed it. Like, Roethlisberger coming back should at least make the offense mediocre. And if the defense stays good, I expect decent things. Now, what kind of form the NFL is going to take this coming season will still be up for a great debate.
Yeah, I don't know. No people in the crowd? That would be weird.
Yeah. Because ratings for the draft were bonkers. I forget what they were, but they were gangbusters, which I wasn't surprised by. But if football comes back and there's no one in attendance, I would imagine that ratings records will be set. Just because literally no one can attend, so that many more eyeballs will be, at least the fans in attendance, those eyeballs will be watching somewhere else.
You know, I wonder if that was, like, the odds makers for these games, because you know how they normally give advantage to the home team. You know, would that affect that at all, you think, with that crowd there to kind of yell, make noise?
Well, I mean, there are certainly a lot of places where kind of you feared playing teams. No one wanted to play the Steelers on the road since their fans traveled so well. okay, that's
a bit. You might be happy with that. The Chargers may not notice a difference if they can't allow
their fans. Yeah, the Chargers are like, oh, thank God. Thank God we cannot let people in here. Maybe we'll start winning and we'll actually have our fans attend our game. Good gravy.
Well, Kevin, if I could maybe turn the topic to a different kind of game, and this is one that you and I used to play quite a bit. Of course, speaking of Magic the Gathering.
Yeah, it has certainly been a passing topic on this show from time to time. I'm not sure, we have definitely not gone this in-depth on the Magic theme, though. Because I believe this is a, was it a Wired.com article?
Yeah, I believe so. This was, referred to by my better half, actually. She came across this article and sent it to me. I think this is the second Matthew article I've gotten from her, which is kind of interesting. I had heard that the market for Magic cards had been pretty strong lately. But this article, I mean, obviously goes into quite a lot of depth about it, but also exposes some facts that I had no idea were going on there. People who kind of how much time and effort, like, in making money doing it, you know, trading in cards.
Oh, yeah, that is one that I guess when I talk about trading cards, I always think back to our high school days, in which I was an erstwhile entrepreneur trying to sell baseball cards at all kinds of local events. And that did not go well. At all.
Where people are looking to buy baseball cards rather than just kind of showing up, you know.
Yeah, there's a lot of, I'm hoping to fleece people. You know, like, you were always hoping to sell that one high-value card that you had. Or to kind of come into that one high-value card. And I just never seemed, like, What was that one thing called in here? Was it packed pocket? I'm trying to think of what the you know, people were taking one pack of cards that you one pack of Magic cards and then flipping cards until they got to like a card that was worth at least a couple of $100s.
Oh,
And
right. Well, I think that's kind of how this, I guess, new attention to the Magic the Gathering economy kind of started. And I think this was in 2010, yes.
yeah.
Pack to Power, it was.
Oh, pack to power. Okay.
So he. Just by using his wits, research, and networking skills, this gentleman managed to, well, his name is Jonathan Medina. He took a $4 pack of cards, eventually, through a series of trades, a total of 98 trades, I guess. He had assembled an impressive binder stacked with valuable cards. And then at a convention, he was able to trade under for a Mox Pearl, which is one of the mean, that is always one of the, well, it's one of the Power Nine cards, so a very valuable card worth $360. So, I mean, still 98 trades. That's a lot of effort, I would say.
And that's where I come into a lot where I'm like, whew, man, was it really worth that effort? Like, that seems like a lot of trading to get to $360. You know, I mean, that really seems like you're either doing some lateral moves almost at some point to get to 98, or you're just like moving up in value so little each time that it took 98
Oh,
trades.
you. It sounds like he was doing research, and so each of those would probably involve some amount of, knowing what you're looking at and kind of mental calculus to see if you're getting the right deal. I don't know. It's not nothing, I would say.
Yeah, it's not nothing, and I guess it depends upon how quickly you did those 98 trades, but that's still also. I just feel like the amount of work outweighs what the pay is.
But speaking to the kind of rise in value of the market, like I said, that was a $360 at the time in 2010 when he traded up for it. But it would be worth between $1,700 and $2,500 today if he hadn't already gotten rid of it.
Yeah, and that's one of those things, and I'm like, man, is there? And I guess this is where I always had the problem with the baseball cards is that I never seem to get a bite on the high-end cards. Because trust me, I saw the price in there for the Black Lotus card. And I want to say that I have one of those somewhere. One, I think. It might have even been my younger brother's who donated his collection to me. So I guess if I do find one and sell it, because what did they say? It was like $16,000? Oh, no. One sold for $166,000 at a 2019 auction.
Right. So, I mean, if you have that card, that's worth a lot of cash there.
Yeah, I mean, if that really is down here, it is sold so quickly that it would make anyone's head spin. Because, you know, the one thing that was kind of funny is they were kind of talking about some of the rarity cards in the different editions of Magic and how they can kind of come back into relevancy by how gameplay is flowing at the time. And I had been thinking with some of my free time, like, maybe I should really go through some of those Magic cards and, you know, start to categorize them and kind of have things laid out a little bit better, or at least separate mana out from everything else to at least cut down on what searching would need to be done.
Well, I haven't looked at any of the sites they mentioned in here, but there are a few sites that are devoted to, you know, seeing what your cards are worth. It would be interesting to kind of like look through some of those, if you could filter it by set somehow, and maybe just look at some of the older cards we could possibly have, and sort of by price. You might be surprised at some of the things you could find in there.
Yeah, I will definitely take some time out, because it just popped into my head that I remember being super pumped about getting the Hand of Justice back in the day. I'm going to have to take a look at that one. It's probably going to be worth like 20 cents. Like, I'm trying, but I mean, it would be interesting because they were talking about the first packs they set, or when they were testing it out, was 1993. Because I definitely remember, like, I feel like we didn't play it. I don't remember playing it in high school proper, but I do feel like I remember coming back from college one semester. And everyone's like, oh, we're playing Magic. Like, everyone had just agreed upon it while I was gone that Magic was the thing to do. And I'm just like, oh, okay. So, I mean, we definitely got the bulk of my collecting definitely came in the earlier days, which could lead to some rarer cards in that regard.
I'd say one thing that Magic cards have over baseball cards into the value is that you do, I mean, they have value in terms of just being, you know, memento, a collector's item, but the Magic cards are actually can be used to play a game. So to me, I don't know, that kind of aids their value a little bit.
I guess that does make, like, the fact that the Wizards of the Coast, the owners of Magic the Gathering, the fact that they make old cards relevant, or re-relevant, I don't know how you want to call it, but, you know, that they...
They'll change the rules periodically to kind of allow cards to be played and increase their value. In fact, yeah. That's how one of the stories go, and that is in this article. Someone received some insider info about a coming rule change, or I think it was a new kind of a new variant play that was going to be introduced soon, which would increase some old cards in value because they'd be now playable again.
Yeah,
some people were able to.
I do remember. I feel like we played with Planeswalkers a little bit. I feel like I might have been stepping out of Magic a little bit at that time. But I do remember...
We went through a little bit of a late resurgence and got some of those Planeswalker cards, I'd say.
Yeah. So, but that would have been before... That would have been... Yeah, I guess if last year was when the insider information was getting handed out... Those Planeswalker cards that we bought would have been the ones he was seeking, I suppose. I might have to...
Potentially.
Man, you mean I might have actually bought good cards somewhat recently? You know, I will admit, every time I walk into a Target, I kind of have a hankering to buy a couple of packs. Like, there is something very thrilling about opening up a fresh pack of cards to see what you get out of there. Like, there's, yeah, there is definitely a junkiness to that part of it that I do enjoy. And yeah, these guys certainly, I think it's just hard for me to obsess on something as well as these guys do.
It reminds me a little bit of the people that we followed and or covered who were extreme, you know, airline miles takers, advantages of, you know.
Yeah.
Like, out there looking for these loopholes. You can find them. And it seems like this probably have an obsessive kind of mind, just based on the tidbit in the article about him being kind of a compulsive gambler, point where in order to stop gambling, he got a job as a dealer, because then he'd be banned from being able to gamble. I thought that was interesting.
And I would think that that would be a fairly well-paying job.
Yeah, I would say you get paid, you know, a lot more than a server or something like that. Yeah.
So that was the one thing. I'm like, dang, man, that's kind of stumbling into a decent job just because you can't, you know, you're a junkie that can't stop gambling.
But then ended up going from there into, well, I think he started playing Magic and then got into poker and then had to get out of poker and then sort of realized that
the Magic scratched that itch.
Well, that Magic, there was opportunities there in the market, I guess. Like, the information wasn't always widely available to everyone everywhere, like how much cards are actually worth. And it sounds like one way he's able to put a lot of money is by kind of going to other countries where, you know, and the local conditions are such that cards are not worth as much. I think he said he went to Ireland and saw, you know, cards that would have been $2,000 back in the U.S. were going for like half that. So he was able to just kind of pull together and just, you know, turn a pretty quick profit.
Yeah, and I do believe that it was another gentleman in the article, because they definitely followed different stories, and I think that some of it would have helped to have a little more of a timeline on these, because I think they kind of mentioned some time frames in the stories. But I still didn't get a, you know, I couldn't tell if it was just definitely a chronological article that they were going through, or if they were kind of jumping through different times. Because, you know, they were talking about how, obviously, like, Magic itself started before the internet was widely available.
Right.
So, yeah, like, there's one area where it's easy to take advantage of an inefficiency when there's a lack of information. When there gets to be so much information, it gets to be tougher because people know what's going on. You know, they kind of know the values of their cards. And I think that people are kind of into Magic enough, you know. And it's almost one of those things that I kind of thought about it as I was reading this one. That I was wondering if we should bring in our good friend from our hometown, Tim Baker, who has a Magic store.
Oh, yeah.
That he runs, that he could definitely weigh in on this topic better than most. And it would be kind of fun to get him on the show. Anyway.
Yeah, there was some interesting thing that was in an article that I hadn't realized is like the connection between magic and Bitcoin. And it seemed like there's more of the thing that tipped me off there's more of a connection than I thought is that Mt. Gox was one of the Bitcoin exchanges.
Right.
And it originally stood for Magic the Gathering Online Exchange. Mt. Gox came from. and it was a Magic the Gathering, marketplace. They also said you could see the value of Magic cards going up every time there would be a spike in Bitcoin, because the same who were trading Bitcoin would, when the market, when the Bitcoin value was high, would use the Bitcoin to buy Magic cards, basically transferring the value from Bitcoin to Magic, the Gathering,
yeah,
which would rise, make the prices go up for all those Magic cards. It seemed like they were saying that it's like old rich guys, guys in their 30s with a lot of money who are, maybe speculating and then end up putting their money into Magic cards, maybe because they played it when they're younger.
These guys certainly seem to have a little more free time than I do. to do. And again, like it's obviously excellent work that they're doing, or else, because you were talking about traveling. The one guy would like do monthly trips to Japan, because like what cards get played here in the U.S. aren't always the same cards that get played in Japan. So like there's like regional biases in how you play the game that you can also exploit the cost of money. Like, I mean, you kind of used the Ireland example, but I mean, it's kind of all over the place.
Right. Yeah, I'm thinking it's interesting because there, and some cards will be maybe worth a dollar in one country, but be worth like $3-4 in a different country. But
yeah,
if you buy enough of those cards, I mean, that would be a pretty big return on your investment. Even though, especially for a card that value, it's probably going to cost more to ship than it would to the value of the card. So you're not going to see that exchange or internationally there. It that's why you could have more like local variation price, I guess. It's not truly an international market. So somebody traveling back and forth like this guy could make some money if he knows what he's doing. It's also totally unregulated, so there's no like danger of insider trading laws being violated or anything like that.
I mean, this article covered a lot of territory, and it certainly did, because that was really the lead off to this article, was the guy that got tipped off about the Planeswalkers cards, that because there's no security exchange, no SEC over the Magic fiefdom, things can things like that can be done without being illegal. They might be morally questionable. I don't know why it was taking me that long to figure out the word morally, but they might be morally questionable, but there's nothing illegal about what these people are doing.
No, I don't think I liked it, but I went back and forth.
Definitely not a fan.
Part of me does kind of admire ability to go out and kind of find these values, but then it does kind of bum me out a little bit that the prices are going so high that a lot of like more casual people aren't able to kind of get these. Although I always felt like those really rare cards were out of my reach, at least when I was younger, for sure. I can remember seeing, you know, like the Moxes were always, you know, always known to be valuable. We just basically never see them, but at least back house growing up. So it was, it always felt that way to me. Like certain cards like Time Twister or, you know, what are the other cards like you would just never see.
Oh, so, yeah.
But the truth be told, you really don't need all those valuable cards in order. And you can have decent decks in certain formats, you know, without having these super expensive cards. So
I can
see both sides of it.
And I feel like the tournaments that, and I haven't really gone to any, but you've gone to a couple of sealed deck tournaments where you're not even, like, unless you find it in the stack of cards that you're given fresh, like, you're not going to have a card like that in play. Like, correct. It's, you know, like, you are definitely looking at it for a certain kind of tournament to be able to use that type of card. And right. I would definitely have to brush up on my Magic skills before wading too far into this market. Unless
I really did have a good, oh yeah, but I really did have a good time at the tournament playing that sealed deck tournament. When you just get the booster card and make your deck right there, that feels like you're kind of more on a level playing field with everybody else. Although I did mostly get my butt kicked anyway, but it was.
Well, there's certainly something that. And I guess I did like that. Like, when you and I had the resurgence, I think we've mentioned or joked a couple of times that sometimes the podcast killed us playing more recently. That, A, I would like to play again sometime. And B, and we already mentioned it, that sometimes they change the rules. Or maybe not change the rules. Or, you know, they just kind of put different types of cards in play that make it easier to play a certain way. Like, I'm not sure that, I remember back in the day, I had a land destruction deck that, I maybe should have called it a mana destruction deck that I love to use, but I'm not sure if that would necessarily still be relevant today with that kind of gameplay or not. Like, would it be quick enough to be able to, you know, stop other people? You know, how has the game developed since then that, you know, maybe it wouldn't be easy to do that?
Well, it seems like the red weenie deck is pretty popular. So I think you could probably find something to put together.
That was still popular?
I think so, yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay. Then, yeah, I think I could probably manage. Mr. Philippe's, we are well over the, well, maybe not well over, but we are over the hour mark. It did not look like you were drinking a Belltime beer, sir.
No, sadly not. This is my second week in a row. Times are tough, my friend.
what are we going to do with you?
Yeah, bit of a cocktail over here. But you seem to have been drinking a beer.
Yes, Seventh Son Brewing Beer Me Tropical Fruit Pale Ale. The fruit ales seem to be quite popular here. They're somewhat adjacent to me to sour beers. You do not get the sour punch from these ones, so they are a little more traditional. But I do like this one because it is more of, they use passion fruit, guava, and raspberry. I would not necessarily call raspberry tropical, but it is it does give it a little bit of a sour edge. I always feel like raspberry kind of has a sourness to it anyway. This was one of the better fruit ales. Like, I think I like it a little bit more than the peach basket that I got from Land Grant. And I feel like there is another one. I do feel like the BrewDog Elvis Juice still might be the king of the fruit ales within the within the area. Like, if I really had a go-to, I think I'd still pick that over Beer Me. But this one is a close second, I would say, in the fruit ale department locally.
Which one was that again?
Beer Me from Seventh Son. It just came out. It's their seventh anniversary beer.
Oh, wow.
For Seventh Son. So, plus it came out on 420. And I'm like, if you're going to drop a beer on 420, I'm here for you. because I also picked up the appropriately named Baked beer also, which was more in reference. It's a s'mores type imperial stout.
Oh, that sounds interesting.
Oh, no, imperial brown ale. I'm sorry. But it's still s'mores flavors.
I am quite a fan of s'mores, so I would be willing to give that beer a try.
So that one will be reviewed at some point here. Plenty of beer talk today, plenty of Steelers talk, plenty of Magic talk. I'm at Defrango11, he's at Gozer33, the brand is at Stunt Granny. Rate and review us on iTunes, SoundCloud, or wherever you happen to listen to us, and have a good night.
See ya.